First of all, I want to apologize about last week. If you remember, though, 2 weeks ago when we had class, I had said I was going to give a shiur last week about Yom HaTzmaut.
Right.
And when Rav Lichtenstein passed away, I was very torn what to do personally. Obviously, he's my teacher for many, many years, and I very much wanted to go to the funeral. On the other hand, I sort of felt an obligation to teach Torah, and I had the sense that had I been able to ask him what to do, he would have told me to go give the shiur. And I was considering possibly the funeral began at 11, if I remember correctly. No, I probably would have if I, although I wasn't sure. I was considering going to the beginning of the funeral and then coming to teach and then going to the burial. It's possible I wouldn't have. I saw in the end I had to just walk there and back, but I saw outside my window there was traffic on the highway for about an hour after the.
4:30.
Yeah. So, and then when I heard that Nechama, who teaches before me, was canceling, I figured there would be a smaller number of people anyway, and it's still worth teaching, but that sort of helped me to, but I want to apologize for that, and therefore I want to do something today. With your permission, I'll give the shiur on Yom HaTzmaut, even though it's after Yom HaTzmaut. It relates a little bit to Yom Yerushalayim, which is coming up in a few weeks. And
sorry, when is the last shiur?
I think it's sometime in June. If I remember, I have to check. Ah, okay, so we have a few more weeks. So with your permission, I'll, instead of Parshat Emor, I'll speak about not exactly what I was going to do last week, but something similar. I also thought perhaps of sharing some of Rav Lichtenstein's Torah, which I don't think I'm going to do directly. Instead, I'd like to do a little version of what I was going to do last week, in a way that's not his ideas, but in a way that I think will enable me to share with you one of the most important things that I got from him. So let me just give a short hakdamah to that. I could speak for hours and hours about Rav Lichtenstein, and I'm not going to. There's so much that's been said and written in the last week or so since his passing. I have a blog, and a number of people expected me to write a blog post, and as of now, I have not yet done so. People said to me, I'm waiting for your blog post. Maybe I will write one about it, but I just feel that I don't want to say something unless I have something to add that hasn't already been said, and so much has been said. And did anyone go to the funeral? It was here. Oh, you were there? Okay, strangely I didn't see you, but if anyone wants to hear, first of all, the entire funeral, it's all in Hebrew, but all of the Hespedim are available on the internet. It was really, really beautiful. 2.5 hours of Hespedim, if anyone's interested. All six of his children spoke, each one, very, very eloquently. And Rav Gigi, one of the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Ezra Bick, one of the Ramim in the Yeshiva, who described himself as a Talmud for 50 years, since he was 15 years old in MTA High School in New York, until now he's a Rebbe in the Yeshiva. And there's other things that have been, Yeshiva University had something also in English, I think in the Yeshiva they had also in English, and so many people have written. I'll just add one little thing that connects, and not even because it's the only thing or most important thing even, but because it connects a little bit to what I want to share in this shiur. So to do that, I'll tell one story, which is how I wound up as a student in Yeshiva Tar Etzion in the first place. I went to Israel for the year after high school, and I grew up in America. And I was a pretty serious kid, and I wanted to go learn here in one of the yeshivot. And at the time, especially in the mid-1980s, the reputation at least was, there were many, many less programs for American students in Israel than there are today. And if you were serious, then you would want to go to one of the Hesda yeshivas. At least that was the perception. And there were really only three Hesda yeshivas at the time that had serious programs. I don't know if Yeshivat HaKotel may have had one or not, but the big three they were known as was Gush and Shalavim and Keren B'Yavne. And I was therefore considering all three. And when I was a student in high school, actually, I had ruled out one of the three. And that was the Gush. And instead I was choosing between Shalavim and Keren B'Yavne. I had a number of people that were encouraging me to go one way or another, teachers and NCSY advisors and other people that had some impact on me. And some people told me that the learning in the Gush is going to be, I don't know if this is true or false, but that's what I was told at the time. That's what I remember as a 17-year-old, that the learning in the Gush, or in Rav Lichtenstein's shiur at least, is going to be higher than anything else. But at least at the time, I had certain people that were telling me that that my religious development would be better off in one of the other two options. That's what they were telling me. And they had managed to convince me of that. And in the end, what's more important, you know, serving God or learning Torah? So I was choosing between those two options. And I had actually narrowed down my choice to one of the two. But in the end, I didn't go to Israel that year. For various reasons, I wound up not going to Israel right after high school. I went to Yeshiva University for a year. And I was going to go the following year. And now it was March of my first year in Yeshiva University. And I was getting ready to go to Israel the next year. And I heard that Rav Lichtenstein was coming to YU, where I was studying now, to do interviews for people who wanted to go there the following year. Now, in theory, I didn't need an interview because I had already applied to Gush the year before, had had an interview with Rav Lichtenstein, and had been accepted. But I figured, why not? Which probably wasn't so wise either, but I said, okay, I'll go, why not? I'll let me spend some time with this great person, even though I'm not going to his yeshiva, but still. And that interview was different. And my first interview, I had been the only one from my high school applying, and I went to New York to meet him, and he actually interviewed me in Rav Soloveitchik's apartment. His father-in-law, Rav Soloveitchik, had an apartment in the dorm, because he lived in Boston and taught in New York. And so Rav Lichtenstein used to stay in that apartment, and I got in there and was given an interview there. But then, this was now a year later, and there were students from NTA, from the high school, that were applying, so he interviewed like six of us at once. It was a group interview. So he sat here, and we all sat around a big table like this. And first he asked each one of us a few questions, what's your name, but publicly, not, you know, whatever. And then he tested us on the Gemara. We were all in the same shir. So he tested us on the Gemara we were learning. We all had open Gemaras. He had a Gemara on his desk, which remained closed. And he would ask us questions. He would be testing people. He would say, okay, you please read the Tosfot. No, not that one, the next one. Skip two lines in the third, yeah, over there, without the book open in front of him. And he basically tested all of us, and that was that. And then the interview was, I must have done okay on that. And then he said to us, does any of you have any questions for me? Sort of like having later on done many, many, many interviews of my own, that's a question that you ask. And I actually, as an interviewer, was happy when a student would respond yes, but usually they don't. But I did. I said, actually, I do have a question. So he looked at me and said, yes. And I figured, you know, this is my chance. People have been telling me that, you know, the Gush is not a place where I'm going to grow religiously. And why? No one argued that Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, the two heads of the yeshiva, were anything other than great tzaddikim. That wasn't the issue exactly. But the reason that I was told this is that in the Gush, I was told that there'd be much less of an emphasis on the learning of Musar and, of classic texts that work on religious development. Instead, they're going to learn Gemara and other things, but not that. And that's why I had been told that it wasn't a good idea. So, in my impetuous 19-year-old way, or 18 years old at that point, I guess, so he said, does anyone have any questions? And I said, yes. I said, Rabbi, I've heard that in your yeshiva you don't learn Musar. And I'm curious if that's true, and if so, why? Isn't Musar important? And he looked at me, and in his classic way, thought for a moment, you could sort of see the file cabinet opening and everything being organized, and he then proceeded to give me a 45-minute lecture, completely organized and systematic, as everything was in his encyclopedic mind, of the history of the Muslim movement in Europe as it developed in the 18th century, what its goals were, how it developed, and why he personally and the yeshiva in general, although there is some classes in Musar, by the way, but not much, because they feel that although the Musar movement had very, very admirable goals, which he and the yeshiva certainly identified with, however, they feel that there are other ways to achieve those goals, mainly through the study of Tanakh, which Yeshivat Har Etzion was one of the first to really, really sort of revitalize after centuries of sort of being neglected in the world of yeshivot, and through the study of various works of philosophy, and why. And I was blown away. Not only by his knowledge. First of all, by the fact that he took the question seriously. And the poor other guys in the interview had to sit through, I'm telling you, 45 minutes of this. But I walked out of that room and I said, I have to learn from this man. And the most important thing I got from that conversation was the fact that nothing's simple. Meaning, it wasn't just learn Musar because you want to be religious or don't learn Musar because that's not important. It was, let's talk about it, there are different possibilities, there are nuances, Nothing's black and white. Nothing's two-dimensional. Everything has multiple facets. And in the end, there's no one right answer to anything. And I will tell you what I believe, and I will tell you passionately what I believe, while I will still recognize that others can believe other things and that that's also legitimate, and that you have to ultimately make your own decisions within certain parameters. And I will share with you as your teacher what I believe and why, and I'll also try to map out for you all the possibilities, which is how we approached everything, right? We approached Sugyot in the Talmud as well. And let's try to, you know, work this out together. And that message of complexity and of insisting on thinking deeply and on examining multiple facets of every issue and of recognizing that there's almost never one single answer to any question, and of respecting the views of those who disagree with you, and even those with whom you disagree strongly, and trying to figure out a nuanced approach to things within that, that's one of the most important things I learned from him. And with that, let me share with you, going now to talk about Yom HaTzma'ut, a version of what I was going to speak about last week, and an analysis of a question that has been and remains the subject of a certain amount of controversy and even conflict within the Torah world, but which sadly doesn't usually get the type of analysis that Rav Lichtenstein gave it. I'm not sure how much of what I'm going to say is quoting him, although some of it is, but certainly at the end I'm going to suggest my own idea as well. But what I'd like to sort of spread out before you and analyze with you is the question of how a Torah Jew should approach Zionism and the State of Israel. And let me first just briefly define those terms, at least the way I want to use them, because here already is where the confusion often begins. First of all, if we talk about the State of Israel, we have to differentiate between the State of Israel and the Land of Israel. The State of Israel, referring to the fact that we have today a Jewish government here, that those of us who live here are ruled by our own brothers and sisters and not by British, Turkish, Arabs, United Nations, or anyone else who has or could theoretically rule over us here. That, as we'll talk about in a moment, and as I'm sure everyone is aware, is the subject of not a small amount of controversy within the Torah world among rabbis and Torah thinkers. And whereas the Land of Israel isn't really the subject of much controversy, meaning the idea that this is a holy land, that there's something very, very unique and special here, that this is where our past is, this is where our future will be, and that there's tremendous merit in living here, and probably a mitzvah to do so, although that last sentence has a small amount of controversy, although much less than people think. That's a separate shear. That is fairly universally accepted. One doesn't need to be a Zionist, I'll define that term in a moment, to make aliyah or to live in Eretz Yisrael, and so we're not talking here about Eretz Yisrael, we're talking about the State of Israel. The idea, as I said, the reality now that we have our own government here, that we're independent in this country. And I'll use the term Zionism, or Tzionut in Hebrew, to define the movement that began probably around 100 years or so, depending on how you define it, before the State of Israel was actually founded. The movement that Herzl's movement, the First Zionist Congress, was only about 50 years earlier, but there were precursors before it as well. And people were talking about a Jewish state long before Herzl, decades before at least. So the movement that sought to establish such a state, and that once it actually came into being, continues to support it and to promote it and to try to, you know, strengthen it, etc. I think it's very well known that among great rabbis and among Torah thinkers, both those who lived before the state actually was a reality, when it was still only a concept, and those who lived afterwards, there have been those who supported the state and saw it as something very, very positive. And many great rabbis have taken that position, and as a result, significant segments of the Orthodox community or the Torah observant community follow that approach. And there have also been others who have not, at least not actively identified with Zionism, have not supported, have not seen it as something worthy of, you know, promotion or support or celebration. And as a result, other significant segments of the Torah observant community take that approach. And a lot of times this comes to the head around the month of Iyar, around the observance of Yom HaTzma'ut, and to some extent also the observance of Yom Yerushalayim in a few weeks. As I'm sure everyone knows, there are communities where it's observed, and there are communities where it's not observed. Now, some of that discussion of how or if it should be observed have to do with various halachic questions, which are important in their own right, and which are not what I'm talking about right now. But the questions of, can you say Hallel or not? If you do say Hallel, can you say the full Hallel or only Chatzi Hallel? Can you make a bracha on a Hallel? Can you not make a bracha on a Hallel? Is one allowed to play music and have celebrations during the days of Sfirat HaOmer? Is one even allowed to create a new holiday that didn't exist before? These are all sorts of halachic discussions, and Rav Lichtenstein himself was always very careful to differentiate between that and the ideological questions, which are separate but unfortunately often get tied up within it. So let's put those questions aside because they're very important, but they're separate issues. I think it's, and unfortunately sometimes the discussion masks itself in these halakhic nuances when what people are arguing about is really something much, much deeper. But there is, so that's that deeper part is what I want to talk about right now. There is a genuine divide, whereas there are those who feel that in one way or another, these days which mark Hey Iyar, which marks the birth and establishment of this state, and Kaf Chet Iyar, which marks the miraculous victories of the army sent by that state in the Six-Day War, are days in which we have to celebrate as days of great miracles and in some way or another express joy and thanksgiving to God, be it through Hallel or not through Hallel, whatever specific details. And there are others who feel that these days aren't something to celebrate, or at the very least, not to celebrate in a religious way. And therefore you'll find Batei Knesset and Yeshivot in the communities that are identified as religious Zionists, or Dati Lumi, or in Chutzlar, sometimes modern Orthodox, or other terms like that, that will have some sort of special tefillah, some sort of special celebration. And you'll find other yeshivot and batei knesset in usually what's described as Haredi or such other terms where you could walk in and find, and if you didn't know, you wouldn't know, right? Everything I said until now I think is fairly well known. Here, though, is where I think things become, this is where many people's understanding ends. And what I'd like to just examine with you are the facts that within that debate, there are numerous subcategories or subdivisions and nuances within those, meaning among those who don't identify with Zionism, there are some distinctions, and among those who do, there are also some distinctions and subdivisions that are, I think, personally very, very important to analyze. I'll spend just a few minutes on those who are not supportive, but then I really want to focus on different approaches to religious Zionism. So just on those who are not Zionists, I think there's a very important distinction, which numerically is becoming less and less significant, because within that community, or among those thinkers, this debate is, I think, more or less been resolved, or being resolved, but at least historically. There were those who were not supportive of the state or its thing, did not necessarily see it in a value, but weren't necessarily opposed either. Whereas there were those who were opposed. Or if you want, you can call them non-Zionists as opposed to anti-Zionists. And there were at least, and maybe there still are a few, great rabbis who believed, both before this was a reality and afterwards, who believed that it is prohibited for the Jewish people to have any independence at all until Mashiach comes. This was certainly the most notable personality associated with this point of view is the Satmar Rav, Zatzal, Rabbi Yoel Moshe Teitelbaum, who wrote an entire sefer about this thick called Vayoel Moshe, with his encyclopedic knowledge, in which he brought hundreds and hundreds of sources, which in his mind backed up this assertion that in an oversimplified nutshell, the argument was God destroyed our Beit HaMikdash thousands of years ago, sent us into Galut, and that was a punishment for our sins. And he told us that when we repent our sins and correct our ways, then he'll bring us back. And that's going to be done by God himself in a miraculous way, according to this point of view. And until that happens, we don't have the right to go ahead and try to do it ourselves. It's okay, perhaps, for small numbers of Jews to live in Eretz Yisrael, as has always been the case. It's even okay for individual Jews, perhaps, to move to Eretz Yisrael, not as a mass movement, and as long as we accept the authority of whoever is the government at the time, be it Arabs, Crusaders, Turks, British, or whoever else is here, and live here under their rule, that's okay, but demanding and certainly using military force to achieve and to defend our ability to control this land on our own, that's prohibited and represents, according to this point of view, nothing less than a rebellion against God. Nothing less than that. And therefore, even after it happened, the state of Israel needs to be dismantled. And the Jewish people has to return the control over the land to somebody else and recognize that our destiny is to remain ruled by others until God himself changes such matters. And that would be tshuva for what we've done wrong until now. This was the position of Satmarab. It's a position of the group identified by the term Niture Karta, which I'm not sure to what extent that group even really still exists. There's a number of individuals that know how to get headlines, both here and in Chutz La'aretz. At one time, it was a large community based in Mea Shearim. There's still some remnants of it, certainly, and certain groups of Hasidim, Toldos Aaron, and others. There's probably a certain number of people that are still associated with that point of view, but at one point in time, it had a much larger following. People who adhere to that point of view cannot support anything to do with the state of Israel completely, regardless of the fact that it's not a religious state. If all members of the Knesset were strictly observant, and all people living here were strictly observant, and all the laws in the state reflected the laws of the Torah, it wouldn't change one iota. In theory, right, they refuse to pay taxes, refuse to vote. In Mea Shearim?
I don't work in Mea Shearim, I used to work in an organization called Galil. And there was a family, Niture Karta, who didn't take anything from
the room. Right. And including, right, there was I don't know if it was this past election or the previous one. Some Satmar group in New York was offering $100 or something like that to anyone who promised that they wouldn't vote. Not that they would vote for this party or that party, but not to vote at all, because voting means you're... Now, the majority of the Haredi world doesn't take this approach at all, right? The attitude is, we didn't necessarily think this was a good idea. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But now it exists. We're not opposed to it in principle. We're not in favor of it either. We're certainly not going to thank God for having created it. It's a reality. Okay, and we'll accept the authority of the country, and we'll follow the laws as we do in every other country. And we will participate in the process. We'll run for Knesset. We'll vote in Knesset and all that. And there's no contradiction between that. And we'll elect representatives to Knesset that are going to promote the needs of our community and our views and ideologies, which is democracy. And in a certain sense, the same thing we do in other countries, right? And Agudas Yisrael, which was the largest, and probably remains the largest worldwide organization of, and which was created historically as a counterweight to the World Zionist Organization, and which was originally opposed to the establishment of the state, it was against it. But once the state became a reality, Agudas Yisrael changed their position and said, okay, now it exists, and the same way we're going to be a lobbying and interest group in the United States and in other countries, so here we're going to be a political party, etc. So that distinction, I think, is often lost on people. And it's important to know that distinction. I say that because I've heard polemicists who don't really support the Satmar position, for example, people who do take money from government subsidies and who do support political parties, etc., you know, quoting some of the Satmar Rav's sources and things like that. Interestingly enough, I don't know if it still exists, but in Mea Shearim there used to be at least one or two Batei Knesset, where on the 5th of Iyar, on Yom HaTzmaut, there was a fast day. It was a Tani Tzibur. Sometimes it fits out there. There's this thing called Bahab. People fast Monday, Thursday, Monday after Nisan. So sometimes, depending on the day of the week, sometimes it comes out anyway. But even not, and they would take out a Sefer Torah and read Vayichal Moshe and Slichot like a fast day. Personally, I've often said that I can sympathize with that position to some extent more than I can with those who ignore it. Because if I say Hallel, which I do, and if somebody else has a Tani Tzibur, so he and I agree on a lot of things. We agree with the fact that something of enormous historical proportions took place on this day 67 years ago. Something even miraculous that was the direct work of God, and that we have a religious responsibility to respond to that great miracle that God did. We agree with that completely. There's only one difference. I think what happened was something very, very good, and he thinks what happened was something very, very bad. So to me, it's more similar to Chanukah, Purim, or maybe even Pesach. To him, it's more similar to the 10th of Tevet or Tisha B'Av. And we respond accordingly, as opposed to someone who simply ignores it, which, although this isn't the intention, could lead one to either completely be blinded to the reality of what's going on, or even worse, to draw the conclusion that maybe God had nothing to do with it. I don't think anybody means that, but that's the conclusion that it could lead to, and that, of course, would be kfira, heresy. Okay, so that's just in terms of the non-Zionist, or the distinction between non-Zionist and anti-Zionist. But what I really want to focus on, and here's something that within our own community, within the religious Zionist community, also isn't often fully understood. It's something that Rav Lichtenstein may discuss a number of occasions, although his own position on this was also very, very nuanced. There are many nuances, but I want to focus on one important nuance which has existed in religious Zionism since its early days, and continues to exist, or a debate, if you will, continues to exist within religious Zionism today. And I'll try to share with you a little bit of analysis of the two positions, including some of the great names associated with each of the two positions. And then I want to talk a little bit about historical developments in these two positions over the last several decades. And at the end, I'll make my own suggestion. All of what I'm about to share with you is in an article that I published a number of years ago, which is on the internet, if anyone's interested.
Which is what?
It's available. You read it?
Wait, I read about the Hallel. Did you say?
No, not about the Hallel. I wrote something about it. No, not about that. Okay, this is something else.
Sorry. What did you say was published by?
I published an article with one of which I'm about to summarize, basically.
Right.
Okay.
But
and
who published it?
It was published. It was a published. YU puts out these things called the To Go. You know, Purim,
yeah.
To Go. So 1 year's Yom Ha'atzmaut To Go is in there, and then I republished it also in one of the MMY journals that year. And if you're interested, I can send you a link on the internet. Okay. The distinction is the following: if someone's a religious Zionist, so based on the terminology that we've laid out here, so that means that the person views the establishment of the State of Israel, if that person was living before it happened, as a concept, as a goal for the future, or afterwards as a reality, as something very, very positive, as something to work towards, as something to support, and to pray to God for, and or thank God for, now that it exists. Within that, anyone who's... I'll define a religious Zionist as anyone who agrees to that statement, that this is something positive, something we should strive for, something we should support, something we should pray to God for, and something that once it's happened, we should thank God for. However we do that, with Hallel, without Hallel, with music, without music, etc. But we should thank God for it in some way or another. Within that, within those great thinkers and religious Jews who would subscribe to that statement, there has always been a split or a subdivision on the following question. Why is this something positive? Why is this something we should support? What is it about it that is significant? And one view has always been the idea that this is going to be, and now that it exists, is... major step in the process of the Geula, the redemption of the Jewish people. In other words, if the Satmar Rav, who we mentioned a few minutes ago, held that the Mashiach is going to come through a process that's completely miraculous and exclusively brought about by God Himself. And we human beings are meant to be completely passive in that. And our role is simply to observe the mitzvah of the Torah, to repent our sins, and to wait for Him to redeem us. So, what I'll call the messianic religious Zionist view doesn't accept that and says no. The redemption of the Jewish people is something that, first of all, even if it involves miracles, or if it may involve miracles, also involves human effort. It's our, not only our right, but perhaps our responsibility to take steps to help bring it about. Steps such as organizing immigration to the land of Israel, raising money to support that immigration, buying land, forming political, and eventually through whatever diplomatic means and military means, bringing about the establishment of a government, and then running the government and an army and everything. That's all part of our job in partnering with God in the bringing about of the redemption. And when it actually happens, what we're seeing is a major step towards the coming of the Mashiach. That view, first of all, was proposed originally, maybe even earlier, but I can point to rabbis who made statements along this line in the early to mid-19th century. Perhaps the most famous name from that time period is a rabbi by the name of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was a great rabbi in Eastern Europe. Kibbutz Tirat Tzvi near Beit Shan, that makes the deli, is named for him. He wrote a very, very important sefer called Drushat Zion in 1860, I believe, 1862, somewhere around there, in which he suggested that in order, again, this is not somebody today reacting to the existence of the State of Israel. It's not even someone like Rav Kook, who I'll talk about in a few minutes, who didn't live to see the State of Israel, but saw a Zionist movement well in process and could see the state, the future state taking form. We're talking about someone back in the 19th century, in 1860, when the Ottoman Empire is still deeply in control here, where there's only a few thousand Jews in Eretz Israel, where the country is mainly a desolate wasteland and where Jews are living all over the world, who back then already wrote an entire sefer in which he said, Mashiach is not going to come only by us sitting here and trying to keep Shabbat and keep the other mitzvot and learn Torah and repent our sins and waiting for God to redeem us, but we have to take practical steps. And he talked about practical steps. He talked about raising money from Jewish philanthropists. He talked about buying land. He talked about lobbying governments. He talked about organizing immigration. When the Chovev Eitz Zion movement, which was one of the organizations that actually began to do this, was founded, he was one of its main supporters. He also talked about something else, which is much more controversial. In his philosophy was also a necessary prerequisite to the coming of the Mashiach, which is that we also have to go to the Har HaBayit and build a Mizbeach and begin to bring Korbanot before Mashiach comes. That was already a much more controversial position, which he conducted debates with a number of other great rabbis about, and that aspect of it certainly did not gain widespread acceptance and is also the subject of a fascinating shiur that perhaps could be had. But okay, that's a unique aspect to his philosophy. But if we remove that from the picture, certainly the idea that what later became known as Zionism and the activities that later brought about the State of Israel was, in his mind, a necessary step towards the coming of the Mashiach. So he said that sort of, you could call it prophetically if you want to, in advance. But of course, later on, the names more closely associated with that in more recent times are Rav Kook, by which I mean Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the first chief rabbi, and by which I also mean his son Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Now, there's a big difference between the two historically, in the sense that the elder Rav Kook died in 1938, if I remember correctly, 36 or 37, around there, and therefore never, 39, somewhere in the late 30s, where he died, and never, therefore, actually saw the state as a reality, whereas Rav Tzvi Yehuda lived through not only the establishment of the state, but also the Six-Day War, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But both the father and the son developed this idea very, very clearly. Rav Kook himself speaks about it in a number of his writings, in many places. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who again presided over an entire community that was already living in the state of Israel and serving in the Israeli army, and his whose own students were among those who liberated the Arab Bayit in 1967. So he you know developed these ideas even much more strongly. And the terms Atchalta de Geula, which is a term that has its origin in the Gemara Masechet Megillah, Atchalta de Geula, which is Aramaic for Hatchalata Geula, or the beginnings of the redemption. So that's a term that, as I said, appears in the Gemara in one context, but which Rav Kook, I believe Rav Kook the father, certainly Rav Tzvi Yehuda developed as sort of a terminology for this concept. And the phrase Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, which you perhaps recognize from the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, right? When after the state was founded, so the first chief rabbi, not the first chief rabbi, the chief rabbi, the first chief rabbi of Medina, the first chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, was Rav Kook. But the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel was Rav Yitzchak Herzog, and he authored, if I understand correctly, the prayer that said pretty standard today in religious Zionist communities, and he included this phrase. The tefillah begins, Avinu shebashamayim tzur Yisrael begoalo, barech et medinat Yisrael. Okay, so until now, what have we said? We've said God, you know, we've referred to him by various terminologies, bless the state of Israel, reshit smichat geulatenu, which is the beginning of the sprouting of our redemption. In other words, explicitly linking the state of Israel to the coming of the Mashiach.
Can you coin that phrase?
I believe so, to the best of my knowledge. However, okay, so that's the messianic view. But there have always been, from the same early days of the mid-19th century until this day, other great rabbis who were also Zionists, who also supported both in word and in deed the establishment of a state, and who celebrated the establishment when it came about. However, either were skeptical about this claim or were explicitly opposed to it. Okay, among the early names is Rav Yitzchak Reines, who was the founder of what became known as Mizrahi, which at one point was the central organization and later political party of the Zionist, religious Zionist movement. I guess it's still the Beit HaYehudi party is, I guess, the... Yeah, maybe it's still officially associated with the Mizrahi movement. I don't know details, but that community. Rav Reines was very, very clear. The term Mizrahi, which was the name he gave his political party, was meant to be, anyone know what it stands for? It has nothing to do with the East. It was meant to be a somehow an abbreviation for the terms Merkaz Ruchani, spiritual center. Okay, and he was very, very clear and very, very opposed to any connection to link this with the coming of the Mashiach. And his attitude was, I have no idea how Mashiach is going to come, and I have no idea what, but one doesn't need to associate this with Mashiach to say it's a good thing. The state of Israel, again, in his mind, as a future concept, but there were those like Rav Soloveitchik who took this view also with the state of Israel as an actual reality, is a wonderful thing. It was a great miracle. And look what the state of Israel does for us. It saves Jews that are in danger. It has in the past, and it remains available for any Jew who needs, whether they're in Ethiopia or in Russia or now maybe in France or in other places. Every Jew knows that there's a place that they can go and there's an army that will defend them. It enables Jews to live in Eretz Yisrael, which we already said everyone agrees is a good thing, and to settle Eretz Yisrael, to perform the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It has a Jewish government that supports Torah learning and yeshivot and also it enables a Jewish renaissance. One can say all of that without this having anything to do with the Mashiach. This could be a very positive thing, even if it has nothing to do with the coming of the Mashiach. And such was the position of Rav Reines, and such was the position of Rav Soloveitchik, who on a number of, although Rav Soloveitchik said different things at different times, but for example, if any of you are familiar with his landmark essay, Kol Dodi Dofik, which is an essay that he wrote based on a speech he gave in 1956 on Yom HaTzma'ut, just a few years after the State of Israel. And the key passage in that essay, he speaks about the six knocks at the door, six great miracles that he thinks took place when the State of Israel was founded, including the things I mentioned and a few others, but none of them have anything to do with the fact that this is the Mashiach, and he was very careful to avoid any such associations. Sometimes, symbolically, you'll find this. Again, I'm not sure how common this is now, but I've definitely heard of people in the past who will recite the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, but either will omit these three words. And it's still a beautiful tefillah. Avinu Sheshmayim, Tzuris HaBagolot, Boreichem Medinat Yisrael. Hagen Aleh Be'efrat Chasdecha. Defend her, protect her, grant good counsel and wisdom to her leaders, defend our soldiers. But just not say this. Or maybe say it, but add a word. Boreichem Medinat Yisrael, Shetihyeh Reishit Tzmichat Gulatenu. Perhaps expressing this, even messianic aspect, as a part of the prayer, as part of the tefillah. Not as a descriptive statement of the present. Meaning, I'm not declaring that this is the beginning of the redemption, but either I'm simply deleting that reference and removing that from the conversation, or I'm even including it, but as a hopeful prayer for the future, and not as a definitive analysis of the present. This is more than just an abstract philosophical question. It has some very significant direct and indirect practical ramifications. One who ascribes to this view of Reishit Tzmichat Gulatenu in its pure form, or Atchalta de Gula in its pure form, has to accept as an article of faith, as an Ikar Emunah Mamash, that the State of Israel will never be destroyed, and will continue to exist forever, and that the Nevuot of the Nevi'im, the prophecies in the Torah and the Tanakh, many of which seem to be well underway if you read them. There are many, many things that it says in the Nevi'im that for centuries seemed like an impossible dream. Kibbutz Galiot, Jews coming back from the four corners of the earth, the land awakening from its slumber, the desolate wasteland coming to life, etc., etc., etc. Zechariah, the famous pasuk that's often quoted that they like to put on park benches all over Yerushalayim, but old men and women sitting on park benches with their canes, watching children play in the streets, which was a vision of some sort of utopian future that's today something that we take for granted, right? Except when people like to put those signs up. There's one like that in the Old City and in other places, right? Which I think is very, very appropriate, right? So this view says, okay, look at to what extent the prophecies have already been fulfilled, and those aspects that haven't yet been fulfilled, and there are many, like peace on earth, for example, right? And all of that. So those will, of course, come to play, and they will be the direct result, sort of organic development. It's all, history is moving in this direction, and what we're living through right now, this is it. And one may, therefore, even draw halachic conclusions from that, that also could affect policy or politics. Rav Tzvi Yehuda taught that any land captured by the Israeli army is, first of all, any war fought by the Israeli army is a mekanim mitzvah, is an obligatory war, not only because it's a war of defense, which perhaps you could agree with even if you don't accept this, but because it's liberating land which is part of the redemption. And he also taught, therefore, that it's forbidden under any circumstances to give this land up under... And that such a thing would be nothing less than a reversal of the redemption. And he took this very seriously. Just an anecdote that I've heard from a number of people, and I believe it's historically accurate. Apparently, one of the many halakhic questions we alluded to is, whether the practices of Avelut and Sfirat HaOmer are in any way to be altered. Right? So one of the questions comes up with haircuts or with men shaving. So I'm sure you know that some men who don't shave during Sfira will shave on Yom HaTzmud and others won't. So sometime in the 1980s, early 1980s, in Merkaz Rav Yeshiva, maybe it was late 70s, he came to the yeshiva to give his drasha as he did every year in Yom HaTzmud. Apparently there were some of the boys sitting in front of them had shaven, and others had not. And he apparently said one can tell by the looks on their face, the looks of their faces, who is a ma'amin and who's a kofir, who's a believer and who's a heretic. And he meant it. Pshuto kimashma. Nothing less than kfira and heresy if you don't see what God's doing. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. The Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, the son of the first Rav Kook. Rav Soloveitchik, for example, was known to have, as I said, rejected those assertions on ideological grounds and also on halakhic grounds, and is known to have said, for example, that if a government believes that giving away some of the land captured in the wars could lead to peace, then it would be permissible. That doesn't have to mean that we should. One can still have the political discussion of whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, but then it's a political discussion and not a religious one. One could theoretically divorce the halachic question of giving away land from the ideological one. One doesn't have to say, if you're messianic Zionist, you could still say that maybe for Pikuach Nefesh we could give away land, and one could be opposed to giving away land even halachically without taking this position, but the two are very closely linked. It also affects other things. It affects the extent to which the state of Israel, someone who believes this, is going to view the state of Israel and anything associated with it as being more important than almost anything else. I mean, this is the Geula. This is the Mashiach. What other Jewish concern could come even close to this? Whereas, if you take a position like Rav Reines' or Rav Soloveitchik, this is something very, very important. But there are also other things that are very, very important. When it comes to questions of funding, when it comes to questions of how much emphasis to put on Jewish communities in Chutzlarts versus here, you know, I mentioned in my article even that Rav Soloveitchik has been invoked. I'm not sure to what extent correctly or incorrectly, but certainly people who have argued against, an all-out push for Aliyah, or at least argued that certain people, rabbis or other leaders of the community, maybe shouldn't even make Aliyah, but should stay in their communities and continue to lead the communities there. So Rav Soloveitchik's view has been invoked in such conversations, perhaps correctly, perhaps incorrectly. But again, there's no question that, you know, to the extent to which you view this as something very, very valuable and important, but not necessarily any different than things that might have existed at other times in the past, or whether you view this as the coming of the redemption, is going to make a very important practical difference. Now, which view is dominant in religious Zionism? So if you look historically, you'll see what I see as a historical pendulum. Okay, until the Six-Day War, the view of Rav Reines and Rav Soloveitchik was at one point the dominant view, certainly before 1948 in religious Zionism, it was the dominant view. Rav Kook's voice was more of a minority view. There was a lot of caution against, you know, describing in such ways. But certainly after the Six-Day War, which I'm not old enough to remember, but some of you assumably are, I can only describe what I've heard. I was born during that war, so I don't remember it. But the clear sense that many people had that, you know, particularly with the liberation of Yerushalayim, that this is it. I mean, this is it. This is the Mashiach. Certainly within the religious Zionist community, that's, I think, what became the catalyst for the view of Rav Kook and mainly Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was leading this movement, to become dominant. It was Rav Tzvi Yehuda's students that formed a movement known as Gush Emunim that led the establishment or the reestablishment of Yishuvim in Yehuda and Shomron, right? We had a state in 1948, but where was our state? In Tel Aviv and in Haifa and in Western Yerushalayim. But all the places that were from the Tanakh, right? Hebron and Beit Lechem and Beit El and Shechem and Yerushalayim even. The real Yerushalayim were still out of our hands. That all changed in 1967, right? And that movement was very clearly driven by this idea that, okay, the Mashiach is here. We're going to go now and build. And what we had until now, Tel Aviv, was a nice step on the way. But now we're going to build Yerushalayim and now we're going to build, you know, Yehuda v'Shomron. And now we're going to... So I think it's pretty clear that it was after 1967 that the messianic version of religious Zionism became so dominant. Rav Gorin at the time also was a major, major force behind this as well, who very clearly identified with this type of thinking. To the point that today there are many people who assume that that's what being a religious Zionist means and don't even understand that Rav Soloveitchik, for example, who was no less of a Zionist, but disagreed on this point. But I think things have started to shift back in the other direction as well, also as a result of historical events. Because in the 48 years since the Six-Day War, at least some of what, certainly the path from there to the final redemption was not as smooth as perhaps some people thought, and there have been a number of events that perhaps can be viewed even as steps backwards. It started in Yamit, and later in Oslo, when the Israeli government, and then of course later in Gush Katif, when it wasn't just that we lost some of the land that we captured. That itself was theologically difficult. I mean, how could it be? If this is the Geula, right? And if the entire state can never be destroyed, and that's a matter of faith. So some took that also to every detail. Like, every inch of land we capture can never be taken away. And there were those who believed that on the level of an Ikar Emunah. And then they saw that just wasn't true. And it's not even that the land was taken away. It's not even like we fought, the enemy attacked and recaptured the land. That might have been bad enough. But from these people's point of view, it was that Israeli government that we see as the instrument of the redemption, sending that army that was the instrument of the redemption to the same army that sent by the same government that captured this land and allowed Jews to build homes there, now took some of those lands, gave them away, and removed the Jews that had built the homes there and destroyed those very same homes. So I'm not old enough to remember Yamit either, really. I remember it as a child, living in America. But I did see Oslo, and more importantly, I saw Gush Katif. And I saw even, I remember the name of a very great rabbi who said, I heard him on the news, quoted as saying before Gush Katif, Hayo lo tiyeh, this will not happen. And people believed that it just won't happen. I also wasn't sure. It was hard, but it did. And therefore, there have been some calls in recent years, and some of the people who went through that, some of them gave up their religious faith entirely. Others maintained their religious faith but gave up their Zionism entirely. And others, perhaps as an antidote to that, said, you know what, maybe this whole messianic thing was a mistake. And maybe it's time to revitalize Rav Soloveitchik's view and Rav Reines' view and say, you know what, okay, the state is very, very positive and we can support it and work towards it and celebrate it and everything and serve in the army and all that without being so sure of what's going to be in the future. But in the 2 or 3 minutes I have left, I want to, personally, Adkan, other great rabbi, not other, Adkan great rabbis from now, me, okay, I'm concerned about the pendulum swinging too far back in the other direction either. Because to me, at least, the fact that, to me it's clear that this is not only, I said at the beginning that this is something like Hanukkah or Purim or Pesach. There's no question in my mind that what happened in 1948 is on the level of Hanukkah or Purim, but there's also no question in my mind that it's actually greater. And it's more on the level of Pesach than Hanukkah or Purim. My study of history has shown me that. I mean, this is not just another great miracle. This is something qualitatively different. And what we have today certainly hasn't existed since the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, and in many ways hasn't existed since the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, even though we don't have the Beit HaMikdash at all. The fulfillment of prophecies, to me, is clear as day. And to completely disassociate this from the coming of the Geula, I think is very, very dangerous also. On the other hand, I think we saw in Yamit and in Gush Katif the dangers of being too sure. So I want to just share with you, and if I had a few more minutes, I'd read it inside, but I'll just tell you outside. The Rambam, in the end of the Mishnah Torah in Hilchot Malachim, when he discusses the coming of the Mashiach, first of all, takes a position which is is opposed by many other Rishonim, and he holds that the ultimate redemption is not going to be messianic, it's not going to be miraculous in nature, no miracles. Okay, but the Geula will happen through simple process of history. That's simple. It's going to be directed by God, but it's not, the Beit HaMikdash is not going to fall out of the sky, descend, build, and we're not going to be carried, the sound of a shofar and suddenly miraculously find ourselves in Yerushalayim, but it's going to be a historic process. That's the Rambam's position. And he says, therefore, so how are you going to know when the Mashiach is actually here? After all, if one believes it's going to be miraculous, so when, you know, the shofar blows and we suddenly find ourselves in Yerushalayim and suddenly Yerushalayim is rebuilt in an instant and the Beit HaMikdash descends from heaven, so we'll know it's here, and until then it's clear that it's not. But if you're talking about a historical development, which first of all is not going to be supernatural in nature, and second of all is going to happen slowly and in stages, then how are you supposed to know? And the Rambam gives a criteria. It's based on the precedent of Bar Kokhba and Rabbi Akiva, which I don't have time to go into, but let me just read to you what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, and this is not directly relevant to what's happening now, but let me just read this Rambam, and then in one sentence I'll explain what I think the relevance might be. The Rambam says, if somebody appears, an individual, and claims to be the Mashiach, I've met such people. I met someone, for example, on King George Street once, who identified himself to me as the Melech HaMashiach, and told me that the problem is that people don't follow him, and that's why, right? So if someone presents himself, okay, whether he's the fellow on King George Street didn't deserve too much serious attention, but there have been others throughout history, both hundreds of years and thousands of years ago and in recent decades as well, who have been believed by many people to be the Mashiach. How are you supposed to know? So he tells us, the Rambam gives you rules, and he has two stages here. He says, Im Ya'amod Melech, this is Hilchot Melechim, Perek Yud Aleph, Halacha Dalet, Im Ya'amod Melech mi Beit David, if a king will arise from the house of David, Hogeba Torah ve'osek b'mitzvot, Ki David Aviv, and this king is a person who's knowledgeable in Torah and involved in observing the Torah. V'yikof kifitor shebichtav v'shebal peh, v'yikof ko Yisrael lelechba ulechazek bidka. And he will enforce the observance of Torah and lead a religious revival among the Jewish people, a king from the house of David doing these things. V'yilachem milchamot Hashem, and fight wars on behalf of God. Hareze bechezkat shu Mashiach. He has there is a presumption that he's the Mashiach, and it's clear from the context of the Rambam that he's referring to the precedent of Bar Kokhba, who met this description, and who was believed by Rabbi Akiva to have been the Mashiach, and who the Rambam feels that although it turned out that it was not correct, that Rabbi Akiva was correct to make that assumption. Okay, chazakah is a halachic term. Chazakah in halacha means, you know, let's say for example I have a mikveh. We talked about a mikveh 2 weeks ago, right? A mikveh has to have a certain amount of water in it. Okay, among its other requirements. And there's a mikveh, and I've measured the mikveh, and I know it has the right amount of water in it. That was a month ago. Every time we use the mikveh, do we have to still measure the mikveh? Maybe some of the water is splashed out, evaporated, whatever. So the halacha is that unless you have reason to suspect that, if someone jumped in and a lot of water came out, or there was a leak, but if there's no reason to assume otherwise, even though we're all aware of the fact that it could be that the mikveh is no longer kosher, but we have the halachic right to assume that it is until we have reason to assume otherwise. That's the same term the Rambam's using here. If you meet such a person, there's the chazaka that he's the Mashiach, and you have to act accordingly, as Rabbi Akiva did, even though you realize it may not be true, you're not yet sure. Im asabi hitzliach, if that process then continues, he was fighting wars. Now v'nitzeach kol umot shesviyav, and he wins all the wars. Ubana mikdash b'mkomo, builds Beit HaMikdash v'kibetz nitchei Yisrael, hareza Mashiach b'vadai. Then you know, when the Beit HaMikdash is built and all the wars are won and all the Jews are back in Eretz Yisrael and there's peace on earth, then you know that the assumption was correct. If not, then you realize retroactively that it was not a correct assumption. Until you know, you treat it as such. That's what the Rambam holds the halacha. This is not directly relevant to us because there's no individual candidate right now and these conditions have not been met right now. But the idea that there's this model where you can say, I'm going to assume that this is the redemption, and I'm going to conduct myself accordingly, even as I constantly remind myself that we don't really know and that it could be otherwise, perhaps that's the model that we need, where we treat this as bechezkat atchalta de geula, so to speak, and continue to see, while realizing that we don't really understand and that there may be setbacks and that we've seen already some setbacks, and God forbid there could be worse setbacks, even though we hope there won't be. and protect ourselves against the spiritual dangers of being too sure, and make the political and halakhic calculations with all their complexity, and this is certainly something that Rav Lichtenstein, even in recent years, fought very much against, those who make, you know, dramatic statements and draw conclusions as a result, particularly in the months before the evacuation of Gush Katif. But on the other hand, to still acknowledge and recognize and assume, so to speak, that this is, and it's not to go all the way to Rav Soloveitchik's extreme either, perhaps there's some middle ground, further nuance, and that's what I'm suggesting. That's me, it's not anyone else. And with that, I will end.